Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. New Mexico and green chili seem inextricably linked, but have you ever wondered how green chili got here in the first place? Or what the life of a chili farmer is like? Or what the future might hold for New Mexico's most famous crop? Today we are talking about the past, present, and future of chili, and we want to hear from you. What are your chili memories? Do you have chili recipes passed down from your relatives? What is your favorite variety of chili? Give us a call at 277-5866, email letstalk@kunm.org, or tweet using the hashtag letstalknm. Now, our first guest this morning is Dr. Paul Minnis, professor emeritus of the University of Oklahoma and an archaeologist specializing in plants of the Southwest. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. It's a wonderful desert morning. I hope it is for you, too.
It's beautiful here. So, Paul, in 2008, you discovered the oldest known cultivated chili seed in the southwestern region of North America. Where did you find it, and what makes this discovery so notable?
Well, we found it in an archaeological site, and it's not only the oldest, it's the only prehistoric chili. It's a wonderful enigma, a nice little interesting mystery of the Southwest. As we know, the ancient subsistence, the farming that supported ancient peoples for thousands of years in the Southwest were based on crops that ultimately were derived in Mesoamerica. Things like corn, squash, beans, gourd, cotton, amaranth, and maybe even a few others. And so there seemed to be almost an open, no border between Mesoamerica and the U.S. Southwest and Northwest Mexico, where these crops came up that were developed in Mesoamerica and became the mainstay. Oddly enough, the one crop, the most important crop in Mesoamerica that we never find archaeologically is the chili. And that's really odd. Why is it? Because there's no reason the chili shouldn't grow in New Mexico or Arizona or Chihuahua or Sonora, because it grows very well. And it's a mainstay of many cuisines of particularly New Mexico. And so it's been a mystery of why all these important Mesoamerican crops made it to the Southwest and Northwest Mexico, and chili didn't. And so in that context, it was really exciting. My colleague Michael Whale and I at the University of Tulsa have been excavating archaeological sites near what is sort of the Chaco Canyon of northern Mexico, and that is called Paquimé or Casas Grandes. And in looking over samples from one of the sites, a small site near Paquimé, lo and behold, here was the first chili seed ever found in a pre-Hispanic site. Well, so, I was pretty excited by that.
So how old are we talking here?
It's about 1200 to 1300 AD. It's very late in prehistory. It's after Chaco. It's sort of equal to the time when populations were expanding in the northern Rio Grande area. So it's about AD 1200 to 1300. Subsequently, in other seasons, we found more. So we have about up to 19 chili seeds that we found.
From this site?
From this site and one right next to it. And so clearly chili's made it at least as far as northern Mexico. I mean, just literally within an hour of the U.S. border. And so why didn't it go farther, like corn and beans and squash and cotton? And so we started looking at the ethnohistorical records. And we came up with our explanation, which unfortunately I think is deeply unsatisfying for native New Mexicans. Mm-hmm. And that is the ancient peoples didn't like spicy foods. They tended to have fairly bland diets. If you look at the kinds of plant remains we find in archaeological sites, and even the plants you find in ancient feces that have been preserved in cliff dwellings, you don't find spicy stuff. And so it could have come up here, but people just didn't seem to want to use it.
So this is pre.
But why do they use it?
This is pre Spanish entry into New Mexico. Chili just doesn't appear to be in the archaeological record in New Mexico.
It isn't. But when you look at archaeological sites that post-date Spanish contact, chili is actually pretty common. There are at least 15 sites in the ancestral Pueblo area, most of them in the northern Rio Grande area, like Abo, for example, or Palace of the Governor, where chili seeds are very common. They've also been found in a historic homestead, Pima indigenous homestead site, in Phoenix and also down in a Spanish mission south of Tucson called Guivave. So they're found quite commonly in certain areas of the Southwest after Spanish contact. And so the logical inference is the Spanish and the Indians that came up with the Spanish, the Tarascans and others, introduced the chilies, and they became mainstays of the indigenous diets, particularly where Spanish control and influence was most profound, such as the northern Rio Grande area. In other areas of the Southwest where the Spanish had less control or less influence, chilies didn't seem to be play as important a part in the cuisine as it did in these areas where the Spanish were very, very important.
Okay, so we are talking about green chili today, and we want to hear from you.
Yeah.
What questions do you have about the history and traditions of Chile and New Mexico? Give us a call at 277-5866. That's in the 505 area code, or email letstalk@kunm.org. So, Paul, once the chili arrived with the Spanish, how quickly did it seem to become part of the culture here?
I can't tell you how quickly, but it was pretty quickly, within, you know, 100 years or something. May I also point out, what's interesting is, while chilies didn't really make it up into the Southwest until the Spanish, once the Columbian Exchange happened, chilies spread very rapidly into the Eastern Hemisphere and became important parts of cuisines all throughout the world, in Africa, in Hungary, in Indonesia, in India, and parts of China. And so it's just really interesting that this short transfer of chilies from Mesoamerica to the Southwest really didn't happen until the Spanish came.
So
it's just a wonderful, wonderful story, historical story about the cuisines and the development of a cuisine.
So let's go back for just a second. What is the Columbian Exchange exactly?
Columbian Exchange is when the New World and the Old World, or the Eastern and the Western Hemisphere, basically met each other when Columbus came over, and there was exchange of all kinds of things, you know, technology and particularly plants. And so food plants that were developed in the Eastern Hemisphere, like wheat, became central to cuisines in the Western Hemisphere. Likewise, plants developed in the New World or the Western Hemisphere, things like corn and beans, and we're talking about chilies, those became incredibly important parts of the cuisine. So there was an exchange of technology and information and ideas, as well as the plants. And it happened very quickly.
So the chili that arrived with the Spanish colonists, was that chili verde? Is that the same kind of chili that we're familiar with today?
Well, we don't know the exact variety. There were about 5 species of chilies that were domesticated in the Western Hemisphere, 3 in South America, 1 in the Caribbean, that is the Tabasco chili, and then 1 in Mesoamerica. It's called Capsicum annuum, and that's the green chili. And there are a lot of different varieties, and we simply don't know which variety of the green chili ultimately was the first brought into the New World. The seeds is what we find. And we just can't tell from the seeds themselves, were they large chilies, were they jalapenos or serranos or anything like that. So we can't tell. We know the species, but we don't know what variety.
So, and when the chili came to the Native American groups here through the Spanish colonists, were they quick to adapt it into their own diets, or did it take some time?
Well, it depends on where they were. Up in the northern Rio Grande, which was sort of the center of Spanish control and influence, it became an integral part of the cuisine probably pretty quickly. In other places like Zuni and Hopi and among Navajo and Apaches, chilies, introduction of chilies and their incorporation as an element in the cuisine took longer. So it all was dependent on where the Spanish were, how their control was, and how far these people were from Spanish influence. There's another point that's interesting. There's a native chili called chiltepín, which is actually the ancestor wild chili that is very important in Sonora, and it grows in the southeast United States. It grows in northern Mexico and Mexico, and it even grows a little bit into Arizona. And it's an important crop now, an important plant. But, you know, we don't find it either in archaeological sites. Only 1 possible chiltepín seed has been found in all the sites excavated in Sonora and Arizona. So it's not just the cultivated chili, but if you look at the Arizona side, it's also the wild ancestor of the chili. So it's a really interesting and fascinating story.
So going back to the chili seed found in Casas Grande,
yes.
Was it so? Are we able to tell whether it was something that was being eaten there or perhaps used for another purpose?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Casas Grandes, like Chaco Canyon, was a center of a culture. It was the religious, economic, and political center that involved hundreds of communities, just like Chaco in northern New Mexico. And we've excavated six sites in the area, and the four sites farthest from the center of Casas Grandes or Pacime didn't have any chilies. And the only chilies we found are the two sites closest to Pacime. That is within about a mile. And so does that mean that it was some kind of prestige, some important Mesoamerican item, like they had shell and copper and other things, macaws that were symbols of importance that important people in that area used? Was chili, were they an important prestige good that only elites or important people used? Well, we don't know. If we look at where we found them in the site, they're just found in trash. There's nothing special. So we don't know if it was just a normal part of the cuisine that for some reason the people at Pacime and Casas Grandes like chilies or willing to use it, or was it a symbol of Mesoamerican connections that people used to show their importance, that they had these Mesoamerican things like shell and copper and macaws and maybe even chilies. We simply don't know. The data is ambiguous.
And how was chili used in the rest of Mesoamerica?
Well, it used in a lot of ways. Obviously, it was eaten. It was a condiment. It was used to discipline children who were misbehaving. They would take children and put their faces over a chili fire, and that would kind of a pepper spray, if you will, of an ancient pepper spray. But mostly it was a food eaten with the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash, and all the other plants that were eaten in Mesoamerica. So it was a very important condiment, a flavoring, a spice.
I see. So similar to how we use it now.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Okay. And so what was the Pueblo diet then like before the chili arrived?
Well, it was heavy. Well, it depends on the time. Once agriculture became the core at about 1000, about AD 0 or 200 AD, when agriculture became the core, it was heavily dependent on corn, maize, and then supplemented by the other two of the three sisters, beans and squash. And then local things were available like yucca and pinon nuts, acorns, weed seeds, little fruits, leaves, things that were local in the area. So it was heavily corn, supplemented by other crops like beans and squash. And then in addition would be what was available locally. And there are hundreds of plants that are edible in various areas of the Southwest and Northwest Mexico.
Now, why do you think the Spanish were so quick to adapt to the use of chili?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question, and you'd have to ask people that study the regions in Mesoamerica, which is not my specialty. But clearly what happened in Mesoamerica, you had the indigenous Mesoamerican foods, and when the Spanish came in, they brought some of their things like livestock, beef, lamb, pork, things of that nature, and they brought wheat and other plants, and there was a fusion of Western Hemisphere foods, the indigenous Western Hemisphere foods with plants from the Eastern Hemisphere, and that became what we think of as Mexican food. So if you think of Mexican food or New Mexican food, you have a combination of garlic is really important, but garlic is a Eastern Hemisphere plant. It was domesticated there. Same thing with onions. Cheese is not a New World or a Western Hemisphere food, and yet corn and beans are, chilies are. So what we eat today at a New Mexican restaurant or in Mexico or in Arizona is a fusion of old world plants and new world plants.
Okay, well, thanks, Jim. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. We want to hear from you. What is your favorite chili variety? Do you have a preference for where your chili comes from, Hatch, Lemitar, or somewhere like Chimayo? Our number is 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. We are also live tweeting the show, so send us your comments using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM, and we are going to take a quick break.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Representing Native American tribes, people facing criminal charges, civil rights plaintiffs, and victims of sexual abuse. Info at RothsteinLaw.com.
Next time you lace up your running shoes, don't forget to take KUNM with you. Our new mobile app has live streaming, our two-week archive, podcasts, and much more to keep you company on your run. Search KUNM in the Apple App Store or Google Play and download today.
To help her strength and endurance while playing the harp, Mallory McHenry stays active. But her harp teacher might not like one of her favorite workouts.
I'm sure she'll find out about this eventually, but no, it definitely has helped with strengthening my fingers.
What is that secret hobby? Join us for the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. We are talking about green chili today, and we are taking your calls, 277-5866, or email letstalk@kunm.org. Now I'd like to welcome Liddy Martinez. She writes the column Liddy's Traditional New Mexican Dishes for the Los Alamos Daily Post and is the author of the book The Chili Line, Historic Northern New Mexico Recipes, which will be coming out later this year. Good morning, Liddy.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Now, as we heard from Dr. Minnis, green chili has been an important part of New Mexico cuisine since at least the time of the first Spanish colonists. Can you tell me about your experiences with chili while you were growing up in northern New Mexico?
Sure. So I always lived on a farm, and we had in my family three generations that lived together. So my grandparents lived with us in addition to our parents. And we all worked on the farm. We always grew a large portion of the food that we ate, and we had a large family that was extended throughout northern New Mexico, so everyone kind of grew their own specialty, and we engaged in the bartering system, which is very traditional to northern New Mexico. And so if one farm is specializing in corn or chicos, which is what our farm grows right now, we would then trade that particular product with our neighbors or our relatives who were growing other crops, and chili, of course, was always one of them. So I can't remember a time when there was not chili in the house, and pretty much at every meal. It's very much a staple in northern New Mexico cuisine, and pretty much every family has their own secret recipe, if you will.
So I've got a call from Luke in Albuquerque. Good morning, Luke. What's your question?
I want to know more about the difference between green and red chilies and why they're important and which one's better, more used for which recipes.
Okay. Liddy, do you have a comment on that?
Sure. So the green chili is picked straight off of the plant, and it's still, of course, in the green form, and that is the chili that we roast. You can also eat it raw, and it is very high in vitamin C and very, very good and very healthy for you. It actually helps to reduce your cholesterol. So cooking with it, there's a variety of ways to use it. One of my favorite dishes is chile rellenos, which is a stuffed green chili that has been, you know, roasted and then is stuffed with either very, very finely chopped aromatics or also some cheese. And then for red chili, red is the mature pod on the plant, and so it starts to turn red as it starts to mature, and you cultivate that and hang it to dry so that it it is really well equipped for storage. So you can put them on a ristra, or you can dry them in other ways on screens, or even in a dehydrator, and that will last for a very long time. So for us, normally green chili was eaten at the in the fall, early fall time, as far as our the menu and what we would make with it. And then later on in the wintertime and early in the year before the spring came, we would rely on the red, which was dried and you know, safe for eating, and you would cultivate it and put it in storage and then use it and reconstitute it to make different types of sauces. Adobada is one way that you can use it, or you can also just use, you know, straight red chili, make it into a powder form so that it's easy to use in the kitchen. So there's a lot of varieties and a lot of ways to use the chili, and the red flavor and the green flavor are very distinct and very different, and how you prepare them is also very different. I hope I answered your question.
It looks like we also have a question from Ray in Albuquerque, who has a question for Dr. Minnis, it looks like. Hi, Ray.
Oh, yes. Good morning. I was interested in when you brought up the chitapin chili from northern Sonora and Arizona. I've only seen it in family gardens. What kind of habitat, since you, I believe you said it was a kind of a wild chili.
Okay,
can you expand on that a little bit?
Are you there, Dr. Bittes?
Hi, Ray. It's a plant that is a perennial. It forms low bushes, actually can be up to 6 or 7 feet tall. And it has these little round, like BBs, red BBs, and they're the wild chili. It's it tends to grow under a nursery plant, a little larger plant until it gets big. And the chilies actually are now harvested commercially in Sonora. They're very expensive, but you can buy them commercially, and there are people who make their living now. It's not cultivated as such, but people will plant wild chilies and collect them. There's usually what they are is they're just little, like little BBs, and you take them with your hand and you just grind them up and put them directly, seeds and the rest of the chili directly into the food, like a stew or something. And normally it's the dried chiltepín that you use. But it is the wild chili. In Texas, it's called bird pepper. In the Southwest, it's called chiltepín. And it's a very flavorful, fairly hot chili. Ray, did that answer your question?
I think it did. I'm going to go back to Liddy Martinez now. Okay. And Liddy, I want to know a little bit more about how you decided to start writing a column that features traditional New Mexican recipes.
Well, it was sort of by accident. I had been posting some pictures on Facebook and some recipes, primarily for my son, who had just left New Mexico to Oklahoma City for school and was trying to make sure that he had access to information for his cooking out there. We were buying chili or getting chili from our freezer and shipping it to him on dry ice so that he could eat it in Oklahoma, which, of course, he couldn't find any green chili there. So trying to bridge that gap for my son and one of my very dear friends, Carol Clark, who is the publisher for the Los Alamos Daily Post, is a friend on Facebook. And so she saw some of the things that I was posting. And when we happened to be at an event for the United Way in Los Alamos, she's on the board. And she asked me if I would be willing to write a column for her that was specifically about Northern New Mexico food. And I was kind of surprised by it. I thought, gosh, I don't know if I have the bandwidth to, you know, take on another responsibility like that. And my husband joked and said, you're sort of already doing it, which I guess I sort of was. So I thought we'd give it a try and started writing the first couple of months. It comes out the first Thursday of every month, and it's seasonal, so depending on what is in the garden, that's usually what I'll write about. And it ended up being a really, you know, wonderful experience for me, and quite surprisingly, it was really well received in the community. It's more than just the recipes. I think it's also, it talks a little bit about the history. It talks about some personal experiences in food and memories with my family and with my grandmother and mom. So,
and in fact, in one of your columns, you write about your grandmother using green chili to cure a cold. Can you tell me a bit about how that works?
Sure. So my grandmother, like most grandmothers in northern New Mexico, I believe, back in that time, were all very learned women who knew a lot about herbs and a lot about the plants in northern New Mexico. And so she was very much into natural healing. And as soon as there was a cough or a sneeze, she was in the kitchen making green chili. And she really, I think that without even understanding the science behind it, she really understood the value of chili and the fact that it is so high in nutrients and in vitamins that would be very, you know, good for your body. And so immediately she would start with the green chili. Of course, the heat in the chili would help with the sore throat. And then she had other remedies that would help kind of, you know, combat that fever and other things. But chili was always a mainstay, as I said, and for a cold or for a cough, it was immediately something that would, you know, put her in the kitchen and get her to cooking. And you know, interestingly enough, it worked.
Now, I understand that you are actually growing some chili of your own now. How has that changed your perception of the crop?
I I started growing my first crop of chili was last year, and I did a lot of study, and I talked to a lot of local farmers to really understand what kind of the tricks were, because I'd never grown it before. And I really did that because I was working on the cookbook, and I wanted to have a really, you know, accessible crop of Big Jim chili, because for the chile rellenos, which is what I was wanting to photograph for the cookbook, it has to be a very large, very meaty, very, you know, straight form kind of chili in order for it to photograph correctly. And so I thought, well, my chances of being able to find that perfect chili is probably better if I have it on hand in my own garden. So I have a lot of respect for chili growers. I have to tell you, it's not an easy gig to start up. But I started small last year. I only had, I think, 10 or 12 plants, and I babied them from the very beginning, putting them, in under heat lamps, grow lamps, and working with the seedlings, transplanting them, and then finally putting them in my garden, and really utilizing the information that the area farmer shared with me about what to do and how to make sure that, you know, the plants were separated the way they needed to, and getting the water from the acequia was also a trick. It's a lot of work, is what I can tell you, but it's quite rewarding when you see those first chilies pulled out of the garden, and you start to roast them, and that aroma just fills the whole surface and the whole neighborhood. Quite frankly, everybody knew what we were doing. I now have 100 plants in my garden.
Oh, wow.
So that tells you, I think, how much I loved it. It's just an incredible experience, and to be able to engage in this kind of cultural experience and something that is so traditional to New Mexico just fills my heart.
Okay, it looks like we have a call from Ben in Albuquerque. Hi, Ben. What would you like to add to the program?
Hey, how are you doing today?
Doing great. What's your comment or question?
I just wanted to touch on the first gentleman who spoke. He was talking about how hard it is to pinpoint origins of where the chilies come from and where they're derived out of. And I grow chilies from like all over the globe. I try and source different local traditional chilies from all over the globe. So I grow everything from like India to, you know, all the way over in like Hungary and Bosnia. And it's really, really hard to find origins of some of these seeds other than basically like fabled tales, kind of like how the lady who was speaking was talking about how the northern New Mexico women had a very good understanding of the chilies in the locale. That's kind of what you'll find, is just a lot of wives' tales and stories as to the origins and etiology, and it's really hard to track down where they're from.
Okay, well, thank you, Ben. And now joining us in the studio is Big Jim Wagner, the owner of Big Jim Farms in Corrales, New Mexico. How are you doing this morning, Jim?
Oh, doing great. Thank you.
So welcome to the show. You are a third-generation chili farmer. Can you tell me a bit about your family's history with Chile Verde?
We've been doing it there in Corrales for about 110 years. My grandfather raised it, and my dad kept the traditional going, and then we're doing it, and our kids are involved in it now too. And we're doing the Big Jim Farms. That's our organic line that we're doing in Los Ranchos area. And it's been a little challenge, because you have to do different stuff, you know, with the bugs. And
are there, like, unique challenges that come with growing chili that you don't find with other crops?
I've always found it the most challenging. You got to be with it day to day. You can't just plant it and think, well, I'll come back next week, 2 weeks to check on it. You got to check for bugs, for moisture in the soils, and make sure you have the right soil test. And it's just we've done it all our life, but there's still new challenges every year that seem to come up. It seemed like it's been more challenging with the bugs and different stuff.
How has it been this year?
It's tough. We had a cold spring, and then we had the heat wave come in June and July that was tough. The plants were barely surviving, but now we got moisture and we got good river water. It seemed like it's really coming around now. So we're a little delayed, but it's going to be right in time here in another week or two when the really pressure for it.
What kind of chili varieties do you grow?
We mainly do the old traditional varieties. They don't produce high volume tonnage like those new ones they have for the big canneries. But our customers are like that. It's the best flavor of any kind.
What's your favorite variety of the ones that you grow?
Big Jim, of course.
Big Jim, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
That's the best. It's the big, meaty, and flavor. And the Sandia has always been a real popular one. It has more heat.
What is the hottest one of the varieties that you grow?
Oh, we have a couple. We do the Lumbre, which we get seed from down south. It's really, really hot, kind of like a double X. And sometimes we'll mix it with the Sandia and give it a good mix so it's not too hot.
Now, something I've always wondered is there a difference between chilies that are grown like in the Albuquerque area and in another part of New Mexico like Hatch or Lemitar?
I don't know. We raise in Lemitar area, Socorro area, and that's a really good place to raise. Albuquerque is really good. This whole Mid-Valley, I think, is the best in the whole state.
Does it change the flavor at all depending on like the kind of soil that's in the area?
I think it does. I've tried chili from different parts of the state, and I think I favor this area. I think it's the best flavor.
Okay, we have a call from Kim in Santa Fe. Hi, Kim. Good morning.
Hi, great show. Kind of a quick story. Years ago, a good friend of mine from Santo Domingo Pueblo, Kiwa man, told me the story that when he was a young boy and they were reluctant to eat hot chili, his mother would say to him, well, if you don't eat our chili, I'm going to take you over to the cousins at Jemez Pueblo, and their chili is going to knock your socks off, so you better eat our chili. And then later, when he came up to Santa Fe to the Indian school and met some kids from Jemez Pueblo, he reported that the Jemez kids' mothers said the same thing, except about Santo Domingo chili. And they laughed about the fact that, they had to be trained to eat hot chili. And I'm wondering if Big Jim and Lydia also experienced that as children, that they had to kind of learn to love hot chili.
Well, let's go to Liddy first. And Liddy, what is your response to that question?
It just made me giggle because I was remembering it was almost like a contest at our house. It was kind of strange. I had a really beloved uncle, my Uncle Johnny, who was just a crazy man. I mean, he wanted the very hottest chili you could find, and we were all just in awe watching him eat some of the chili that he would eat. It was just remarkable. And he would be crying and sweating, and he would not stop. And so I think that role modeling definitely had a lot to do with our intent on making sure that we were not left behind with regard to how hot our chili could be. I used to eat very hot chili and really, really enjoyed it. As I've gotten older, my body just can't take it anymore. So I stick to the medium heat. But I think the flavor and the area where they're grown definitely does have some impact on the chili and the environment. And I love chili from all over the state. I've eaten it from everywhere, and it's all very distinctive and very good. But, that whole contest about who can eat the hottest chili, it gets a little crazy. But certainly I think that is counted as training.
Now, Jim, were you as a third-generation chili farmer growing up around undoubtedly lots of people who eat chili, were you ever threatened with chili like Kim has told us about?
Not really. I've had the real hottest you could eat, and kind of like her, you get older in age and you can't handle it. The flavor is awesome, is that the hotter, the better the flavor, but then you pay for it.
True
so,
enough.
So, I don't know. I'm more kind of a medium to hot eat. I like now, because that's where the flavor is, and I think that Sandia hot and Big Jim's about perfect. We mix it together, and that's our mix. But I've had some people come, and they say, I want the hottest and hottest, and I warn them, and I said, here, get this triple, quadruple vein Lumbre or whatever I have. It's the super hot, and they eat it, but they run for water, and they're gasping, and their head's turning red, sweating, and So but some people could eat it. It's amazing. I don't know how they do it.
More of a challenge. So thank you for joining us today for Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. We will be back in a minute.
This Friday morning on University Showcase, rethinking our assumptions about what society looked like before the Civil War.
All blacks living in the South were slaves before the Civil War. All white people owned slaves before the Civil War, and neither of those were true. In fact, a hefty percentage of African Americans were living free in the South since 1619.
That's University Showcase, Friday morning at 8 on KUNM.
Is the New Mexico heat too much for that old engine? If your old car or truck just can't take it anymore, if it keeps letting you down, now's the time to let it go and turn it into great radio. KUNM's vehicle donation program turns old cars and trucks into a membership plus a tax deduction for you. And it's an easy way to help keep great programming on KUNM. Condition doesn't matter as long as it has an engine. It just takes one phone call to 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are discussing all things green chili today, and we'd love to hear from you. Have you ever tried growing your own chili? How did it turn out? How about using chili for non-food purposes like curing a cold or relieving pain? Give us a call at 277-5866 or tweet using the hashtag Let's Talk New Mexico. I have Jim Wagner here with us with Big Jim Farms in Corrales, New Mexico. And Jim, what sort of advice do you have for folks who might want to grow some of their own chilies in the future?
I encourage people to grow it. It's very exciting, and especially you grow it and you taste it. And I always like to tell them, you know, start off with good soil, with compost, and get good seed, and just keep with it. Stay with it, though. You got to be with it. Almost every day, check your plants for water, for bugs, and before you know it, you have a crop.
Okay, and it looks like we have a call from Madalna in Albuquerque. Madalna, I understand that you want to talk about a hot button issue.
Thanks. Hi, Madalena, actually.
Okay, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, so I'm born and raised in New Mexico. My family goes a very long way back here in this state. And I recently moved back after being in Denver for 9 years. And while I was there, there was a lot of controversy around the green chili of Colorado. I know that it was kind of put up for the Super Bowl when I was living in Denver as one of the bets. And a lot of New Mexicans, which I don't blame them, got really upset about who really owns the green chili. And to be honest, it was quite a culture shock in the way that it was prepared and made. And I was very pro-New Mexico, by the way, and defended our chili at every chance I got.
Go right ahead.
I was just going to say it was really interesting to me, though, in getting to know some of the folks whose families went way back in Colorado about some of their traditions, which were similar to and different from northern New Mexico. But also one person related the preparation of the chili. A lot of it has to do with the fact that Colorado, as you know, is much colder than most of New Mexico. And it was a way of saving. So they make kind of a gravy out of it, in my estimation, a little bit similar to our green chili stew. And so that was really a way for them to kind of enjoy it throughout the cold months, which is very different from how we utilize our green chili here.
Okay. I think I'd like to go to Dr. Menes for this. You seem like you're probably the closest thing to a neutral party in this issue, not being from New Mexico. So Dr. Menes, what do you have to say about Colorado chili?
Well, I may not be as neutral as you think. I was raised in Denver, and I lived in Albuquerque and Santa Fe for many years. I am not going to get involved with who has the best chilies, whether it be Colorado or New Mexico or Hatch versus Chimayo. However, the New Mexico governor was wrong in saying that that the Colorado governor didn't know how to spell chili. Now, in New Mexico, you spell it C-H-I-L-E. But in fact, C-H-I-L-I is a reasonable and official English word for the chili. You can spell it either way. And so your governor was, in fact, wrong by claiming that the Colorado governor was spelling chili wrong. So in terms of which is better chili, I'm staying out of that. I just would like to point out that the New Mexico governor was wrong. You can spell it either way, and that's correct in English.
It's important that we focus on the facts.
I may have stepped in it on this one.
Well, now to talk about one of Chile's future paths, I'd like to welcome Jacob Torres to the program. Jacob is a technical and horticultural scientist with NASA. Good morning, Jacob.
Good morning, Ty. How are you doing?
We're doing great down here. So earlier this year, NASA announced that Española chilies will be grown on the International Space Station in order to explore the possibilities of growing food for deep space missions or even extraplanetary colonization. Jacob, you're a member of the team that developed the project. What makes this different than earlier experiments with growing crops in space?
What makes this different than other experiments that we've done in growing crops in space is this will be our first fruiting crop that we grow on the space station. Currently, we've only grown leafy greens like lettuce and Mizuna mustard, and actually stepping up into a fruiting plant is a first for us, for NASA.
And why a chili pepper? What makes them well-suited for this test?
Sure, there's several reasons why we chose a chili pepper. One of them starts with the nutritional needs of astronauts whenever they're in space or on deep space missions. We were able to supply food to them, meals ready to eat, but the nutrition and the vitamins that are in them, they degrade over time. So an astronaut who's on a deep space mission, maybe going to the moon or to Mars, will need something to supplement their diet. Peppers turns out to have some nutrients in them that are really valuable to an astronaut's diet, like vitamin C and creatine. So the nutritional value in a pepper is one reason why we went with peppers. Another reason, there are no bees in space. On the International Space Station, we don't have pollinators. And with anything that we send up there needs to be self-pollinating or easy to pollinate. A cool thing about the chili pepper is that essentially the female and male parts of the flower are in one spot, and an astronaut can walk up, tap on it, and that'll pollinate the flower. So the astronaut serves as the bee.
And does the flavor play a role at all?
Absolutely. And that's the final factor, is the flavor. Astronauts report with the lack of gravity, having this feeling of a cold in space. And it's all about the blood that's flowing in your body. Instead of pulling down into it, it actually sticks in the head. And they feel like they are congested, like they have a head cold. Having something that's spicy and bright, like a pepper, tastes really good, and it's good for morale.
Now, I've got to point out that you are an Española native. Did you have any influence in choosing the variety of fruiting plant that will be grown on the space station?
Sure. I am an Española native. I was born in Santa Fe. I think that the influence that I had was just my knowledge in the peppers of New Mexico and then the growth seasons. It's from the south part of the state to the north side of part of the state. We were looking at hatch peppers when I arrived here, and that's because there's a lot of work that's available on the hatch peppers. Naturally, NASA picked that up because there's a lot of scholarly academic papers written. When I came in, I saw that they were looking at hatch peppers, and also in the space station, you can only have so much crew interaction. There's only so much time to grow the plants. If you can have a plant that grows quicker, that would be good. And so my input was, well, in Española, we are 4,000, 5,000 feet higher. Our growth season is shorter, and the Española pepper would fruit quicker than maybe the hatch variety would.
Okay, so once these peppers are grown on the space station, will the researchers actually be able to taste them in space?
At some point, somewhere down the road, the astronauts will be able to taste them, and that'll be a really exciting day. And they'll get to ask themselves, should we eat it red, or should we eat it green, or should we wait till they turn red? So in space, they'll be asking red or green.
Excellent.
But we want to make sure that it's safe before we allow the astronauts to eat it. We don't want them to get sick or have any microbiology on it. So the first plants that we grow will be shipped down to Earth. And we'll do nutritional analysis on them as well as microbiology analysis before we give them the okay to eat it. But at some point, yes, they will.
OK, Okay, it looks like I have a call from Michael. Good morning, Michael. What's your comment or question?
Hey, good morning, Ty. How you doing?
Doing great. What would you like to add to the program today?
Well, as I listen to this program, I hear lots of points that I would like to hit on, but I'll just try to keep it brief. I've been a huge chili fan since I first moved to New Mexico in 1990. Pretty much eat it with probably 90% of my meals and take it with me everywhere I go. And it's the first thing I eat when I come back after I've been somewhere for a while and haven't been able to get it. I was pleased to hear that you had Mr. Wagner on. I'm a regular customer at Wagner's. We buy chilies up there every year. And you're talking about varieties. I heard a couple of years ago, discovered a variety that I haven't seen anywhere else except Wagner's called Little Junies, which is a red chili. It's a fresh red chili, and it is outstanding. Maybe I'm shooting myself in the foot by saying check it out, but because I want to make sure that I get some when I get up to Wagner's again this season. But it's a really – I mostly ate green chili, but that red chili has an amazing flavor. It's nice and big and just a really great flavor.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael. And we're going to go ahead and take another call from Lisa in Albuquerque. Hi, Lisa. What's your comment or question this morning?
Hi there. I'm sorry. I turned on the show late, and I'm not sure if I understood the lady's name right. Is it Libby that writes the column?
It's Liddy.
Okay. She mentioned, I'm so curious about the chili rellenos. The traditional that I've had is stuff with cheese, and she mentioned aromatics, and I'm really curious to find out what are those aromatics, and are there different kinds that they do? I'm so interested in finding out how else she prepares those without cheese.
Well, that sounds like Liddy, that's your area here. So what do you have to, how do you respond?
So in my family, my mother used to make chile rellenos normally without cheese, and the reason for that was because I had some siblings and relatives who had sensitivity to dairy, and so she used to make a filling that was very, very finely chopped garlic, red onion, and tomatoes, and mix that up like a salsa. And then put in very, very finely chopped, like a chiffonade of the cilantro, and then stuff the chili with that. Now, I make it the same way. I use all of those ingredients in my chile relleno, but I also add cheese, so it has the added gooey cheese flavor that I really do like. And but really, with a chile relleno, the beauty of a chile relleno is that you can put pretty much anything in it. I've had a variety of experimentation in just pulling whatever's fresh out of my garden and giving it a try. And so one of the things that you might want to also think about if you want to do something that is vegan is you can also do calabacitas, so that's squash with corn, and because of the way that they are prepared, just finely chopped, they're very easy to put into the chili and they won't spill out, and the flavor, it changes with the filling, of course, but there's a wide variety of ways to make chile rellenos, and I really encourage experimentation because that's how you'll find the perfect one for you.
And I'd like to go to Jim. Jim, what is your favorite chili dish?
Oh, I'd say enchiladas, and I like calabacitas with it. One of my favorite. Either in the morning with breakfast or lunch.
Okay, so enchiladas is the way to go?
I think so. I really like them, but I like everything. I'm a big chili eater. I can't live without chilies.
As long as it's got chilies in it, you're there. Okay, so let's go to Mike in Albuquerque. Good morning, Mike. What would you like to add to the program?
I know you're coming to the end of the show, so I'll make this fast. I just want to point out that not all chili roasting is the same. There's a company in Albuquerque. It's a family-owned. It's a meat market called Nelson's. And they took a pizza oven, a roller transport pizza oven. I'm sorry, my dogs are playing. I'm outside. And they took a roller transport pizza oven, and they roasted. They perfectly roast chilies. And it's really cool. And you end up with a perfectly roasted chili with that being banged around and everything. And it's a local business.
Okay. So, Liddy, I'd like to go to you again. Do you have any tips for roasting chilies?
I actually do all of my chili roasting just right on my grill outside. I agree that the tumbling is convenient, and it's quick to be able to get, you know, large volume.
I've lost sound.
The grill, and it comes out perfectly. It's not damaged, and it's very easy to peel.
Okay, so thank you very much. And let's go to Jacob Torres. How soon are we going to be able to see chili grown on Mars? When? What's the timetable for this?
Growing on Mars probably won't happen until the 2030s.
Okay.
Growing on the moon is very much so a possibility within the next 4 years. There are maybe this is a little bit, but there are conversations that are going around about growing this Española improved pepper on the moon. And then in the actual space station, we will grow that at the beginning of the year, around January of 2020.
Okay, excellent. So something to look forward to in the news there. So let's go back to Jim. Do you do any roasting of your own chilies, or is that kind of outsourced?
No, we do. We have a lot of chili roasters, and we'll take them to different locations. If we go to farmers markets, we'll take one, and just wherever needed. People won't buy chili if you don't roast it. It's too much work to do it on the grill. A whole sack could take you 2 or 3 hours.
Now, how long have you been growing chili yourself?
Since a little kid, probably 50 years.
And how has the process of growing chili changed during your lifetime?
Not a whole lot. I learned it growing up, and it hasn't changed a whole lot.
Are there new techniques or customer preferences that have changed?
Not really, not much. We've modernized our planters and different equipment, but as far as just growing it throughout the season, pretty much the same it's been.
What about organic chili? Is that something that you're seeing a demand for?
I am. People these days, they want it. They don't want no pesticides or herbicides. We've always wished to do, you see bugs, go spray them, see weeds, but now we're using more mowers and hose, more physical labor to keep it clean. But I've noticed the taste is like day and night. The taste is so much better, and it's real healthy.
So you're finding that the organic chili actually tastes better?
I am. I think so. A lot of my customers have really liked it.
Okay, well, that is all the time that we have today. Thanks to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. And thank you so much to our guests. The conversation does not have to end here. You can share your thoughts by commenting on KUNM.org or email letstalk@KUNM.org. If you missed part of the show, stream it online or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Next Thursday, we will be looking at the impact that functioning streetlights have on crime in Albuquerque communities. I am Ty Bannerman. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Taylor Velasquez screened your calls. Bryce Dix live tweeted the show. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.